Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to review the play reports for our newest adventure, the Scarlet Stockade of the Bear Druid, which is our seventh dungeon design dash created live and run at GaryCon 18 just 2 weeks ago. We were shocked to find out that we had totally reverse play experiences. So today, we're going to throw down and figure out why that was. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I will remind everyone that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our After Party Chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all our patrons, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier level, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account all set up and ready over there during the course of the show, and about maybe 10 minutes after the end of the show, we will be there live.
We love that part of our week, and big thanks to one of our top patrons, Bacrius, who's confirming that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream, so thank you very much for that. So this is the second episode in a row that we are kind of debriefing from our amazing experience at GaryCon 18 out in Lake Geneva. And again, thanks everybody for making such a great convention out there. So last week we were talking about our experiences at the con in general. And then this week, we're going to dig in a little bit more focused on the stuff that we actually did, particularly the dungeon design dash that we did do live in the auditorium theater there, and also live here on YouTube. You can see that archived on our YouTube channel, where we made a brand new dungeon about 90 minutes and then ran it the next day.
It's worth noting that we are now maybe I'm going to say a third the way through our glut of convention going. We have our own house convention coming up this weekend, and then 2 weeks after that we have Rising Phoenix Game Con, where we'll be doing yet another dungeon design dash. And I'll even note that at the house con this weekend, I will be running one of the old dungeon design dashes for some folks. So my brain is really heavily in dungeon design dash mode right now. I'm excited to talk about it.
Excellent. And I think this one went, I realize that we've been intending to do this for a while. I think that the design part was delightful. And as we said last time, having a bunch of people in the room physically to help us, many of whom are, you know, patrons and viewers of the show here, was fantastic, both getting to meet them for the first time and actually be involved in the design process. And we've talked about it a number of times, but it occurred to me, Paul, that this GaryCon was the first time that we actually successfully executed on having two playtests in parallel. Because we tried to do that the last year, and I had a scheduling problem that wound up not actually happening last year at RPGCon. So we got to play, I guess it was Saturday that we had our two playthroughs, and we were... And I think that was really super valuable because we had totally different play experiences when we touched base afterwards.
Before we jump into the play tests, I want to just talk about the design process a little bit. Let's go back to that. I think you know, it was super fun. I agree to be there, have folks on site. I really enjoyed that energy. I'd love to keep pushing the envelope on that and see if we can get bigger crowds at these things. I think that's really fun. And I was surprised by just how many folks we had in the audience who were familiar with the show. I was not expecting that. So that was delightful. And also just to get to connect with folks that we normally only know them by their Discord handle. Yeah. So to get to, you know, put some faces to names was really nice. So there's one thing I want to pick apart here about the design process. You know, we say we're trying to do it in an hour. We generally schedule ourselves 2 hours to do it live. You know, there's a bunch of setup and teardown, right? A bunch of technical nonsense we have to get through. But honestly, I do think the 90-minute mark is probably more realistic to what we're building. Yeah. Now, that said, I question, are we building enough content? Is the size of the dungeon that we can fit in designing in an hour does that map well to the amount of content you want for a 4-hour game at a convention?
Well, okay, so I apologize. This cues a little bit into our playtest experiences because on this particular testing session, you and I might have opposite answers to that question just based on that one day of playtesting.
And we can get into that, but I will say this. I have also been, as a matter of course, been going through the previous old, old dungeon design dashes and running them at conventions. And so I've run, I think the first three at this point. I'm trying to remember which one I'm signed up to run this year. I'm going to look at my schedule and find out. I ran the last one live at Rising Phoenix Game Con. Right. I did that. This year I am running WDM03. So I've run 1 and 2, as well as we just did 7. So I guess 6 I've run. At a convention, all of them have ended early. Every single one of them has the players have seen all of the content.
Okay.
And typically end early.
Interesting.
So there's a little part of me that's trying to question. And the question I have is, which is more important, fitting the format of how long we stream for to build these things? Because I'm sure if we double the size of the dungeon, I'm sure that we would have to double the length of the show,
right
or do it in two shows or something like that. Is that more interesting, or is it fine that we're generating these kind of much smaller dungeons and they don't perfectly fit in a 4-hour convention game and they're not really built for that anyway, so who cares?
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting observation that they I guess now that I think back upon it, the times that you've told me the story of playing through it, I hadn't put it together that they're always ending early for you.
Generally, that's not necessarily a bad thing at a convention. Oftentimes, what I find is when you end after 3 hours of play, people are content with that, right? They're like, oh, great. I got a little extra time back and I had a good time. It was fun. I feel like I succeeded. I did all the things. That's fine. Yeah. Also, there's a little bit of function of just the party size, right? A bigger party is going to go slower. So, it may just be a fluke of how many people I got to sign up for any given game.
Right.
But usually, I will say this, usually when I am queuing up to run a convention game, we're designing maybe about 10 rooms, plus or minus, two, when we do these dashes. Yeah. If I'm looking for a game to fit a 4-hour convention game, I'm usually looking for more than that, right? Because I want there to be more content than they will ever see. And I'm usually looking for more in the range of, like, maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 rooms, maybe?
Interesting.
Something like that.
Okay.
With the assumption that there's no way they're going to see the whole thing. Like, I just, right, they may go left, they may go right, they may see this piece of the dungeon, they may see that piece of the dungeon. One of my favorite ones was running a one-page dungeon that I had written that I think is close to 30 rooms, but has 3 exits. And so, like, which way the players choose to go could impact the situation quite a bit.
Interesting. I'll confess that my thinking is maybe partly affected by like the old tournament modules that they wanted to be challenging but doable within 3 or 4 hours. Like the A series, they definitely had dialed into, we're going to have 9 significant encounter areas, maybe in about a dozen rooms, maybe about 12. And I usually find from my games when I've kept records that for a significant encounter, even with original D&D, tends to be on the order of about 30 minutes to get to, explore, engage with, complete one encounter. So in 4 hours, I do tend to find like eight-ish. Eight-ish is on the order of what I get through usually.
Interesting.
Maybe you get to accomplish things faster than I do, possibly.
Just a speedy DM. Maybe I'm too loose with the rules.
I mean, I have there is a bullet point in my review notes here with, I think, an exclamation mark of like, I am not going to make an encounter easier or harder on the fly. And I'm not saying that you do that, but some DMs do that. And in fact, some very famous DMs were saying that at a seminar panel at GaryCon. I was like, okay, that I don't agree with.
Well, we can get into that one when we start comparing notes about the thing. So there's So I, you know, regardless, we've already got the map locked in for Rising Phoenix. Yeah. So we'll get at least one more data point so we can come back to this particular conversation. And that's fine. There was one other design element that I wanted to run by you, which is I love using Matt Finch's tables that we use at the very beginning to get usually what we start with. I can't remember what it's just like the name of the adventure, the name of the location, I think he calls it, where we string together four words, blank blank of the blank blank, and it's delightful. It works really well in creating the content, but typically after the fact, when I look back at the final product, I go, well, that title gives way too much away to the players. And if I put that in the convention listing as the name of the game, it's giving away too much. So here's my other thought to you about the design process. Should we, at the end, rename the adventure? Or consider renaming.
I agree with this particular one that the name of this one in particular would give away a big component. Would have totally changed the play experience that I had. So when I was promoting it or talking about it, I was just slicing off the first part and calling it the Scarlet Stockade Adventure. So that I'm warmer to. This one in particular, I guess I'm warmer to that.
Let's consider that as we go through the course of the discussion today. And I'll toss this out to our viewers, maybe. Viewers, as we're talking about this, especially anyone who watched it, as we're talking about it, weigh in the chat and let us know if you think we should rename it, and B, what you think the name should be. I'd love
to hear. That's good. That's good. Hey, can I throw two comments in the chat right at the moment? One of them from Mysterious JGM, I totally agree with this, is saying, I think the point of a tournament adventure is that there'd be too much to do so that you could rate parties by how far they got. And, has always been my sense that the tournament adventures are specifically really hard. And I can think of some academic exam competitive exam situations that are similar, is you don't want multiple people maxing out the score. And you want it to be easy to pick one particular person, one particular group clearly got further than the rest. So point taken. I'll say that at the Legends of Wargaming AD&D tournament that I got to be one of the referees at, Gary Kahn, Friday night, we actually had that problem. So of 19 parties and 19 separate judges, when we had the debrief post-mortem at the end, three DMs showed up and said, my party maxed out the score. They saw all and that adventure had on the order of, I think, 40 or 50 encounter areas. And somehow three separate parties had explored all of them, found every single quest item, lost no characters in the process, and gotten out for a maximum score. And then we had an awkward debate between those three DMs and Paul Stormberg, who was administering the whole thing, about how we could determine now who the ultimate champion was when there's a three-way tie. So that was... I didn't expect to see that. I was agog that three parties had maxed out the score. I almost couldn't believe it. And it was really awkward. So yes, in a tournament situation, you want to avoid that, and you want to have it indeed super hard to get through. And that's maybe not the goal for our dungeon design dashes. So good point on that. And the other thing, so here's Buster Bluth. Has a comment here. Quick question. After the dash, he was there for the Thursday night dash and also my playtest Saturday. Thank you so much for joining that. How much fleshing out and adding details occurred between the dash and the actual run?
Oh, good question.
Not a lot. I think, and that is a good question. I think late Thursday night, I think I spent about an hour with me going through adding statistics, tweaking some of the monsters a little bit. For example, I actually changed the Hydra from 6 heads to 10 heads. I added in some additional treasure details and stuff like that. And that process took me about an hour. And then Paul came through after that. And how long did your bit take, Paul?
Gosh, you know, probably no more than an hour or two. And my pass was more about language and formatting. So in my case, I took our rough, sketchy notes and I expanded them into more proper sentences. I used boldface fonts here and there to call out the monsters and the treasures, just to all make it a little bit more readable when we were at the table. And also, just it forces me to reread everything and try to remember some of the notes. Now, part of my process there is to scrape the full transcript of the previous night's, of the previous recording of the actual play, and then hunt through that so that I can pick out, you know, details of like, oh, I forgot to write down this thing or whatever. So mostly it's just a kind of like taking the bones and just putting a little meat on them. So I'm not really changing anything of any significance. Just recording more things that I forgot. And we were really fortunate at GaryCon that they had this lovely GM's lounge with a printer available. So I was able to go there and take that final product and print out copies for both Dan and I to have at the table, which I think was incredibly helpful. To the end of like, gosh, maybe when we go to Rising Phoenix, I'll just pack a printer to bring with me because holy crap, that was helpful.
That was really key. Yeah. And now I, in particular, I do like having the paper adventure. And there was a question of like, could I run it on the phone, on my phone if I needed to, which I would not be super happy about that. Or maybe a laptop. So I did like having, I do like having the paper that I can easily annotate without thinking about it too much. So viewers, this particular case, what happened is more or less, I did the math tweaking and Paul did the English tweaking. And fortunately, I have complete confidence that either one of us could have done either one of those jobs, but that's the way it worked out this time I did math, Paul did words, so it worked out pretty well. And when I got Paul's revision, I was very happy to have that.
Yeah, I think that was great. I'm going to throw one comment up here because Vino Azul is already stealing one of my rename ideas, which I thought I was very clever about. Proposing Scarlet Prison of the Bear Druid, aka the Scarlet Stockade. I absolutely want to change the spelling of bear. I want to use the other bear. I think that's hilarious.
Okay.
Because he is bear and he's a bear.
Yeah.
I don't, anyway.
Now, okay. Counter argument. Great. I love it. Counter argument. Yeah. But if we're communicating with someone verbally and that's a homonym, they might take it the original way anyway, and that doesn't solve our problem.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And to which end, I kind of do actually want to rename it just the Scarlet Stockades or something like that. Maybe just to eliminate the Bear Druid part of it from the title entirely is probably... Scarlet Stockade has a nice ring to it, right?
I agree with that. That also rings pretty well. Now, William's pointing out that, maybe the title of the module is just something that the DM expects to see when they're purchasing it. But this one is so on the nose that if you blurt out those three syllables, it completely gives away the whole adventure.
And ultimately, you know, it is a thing that sometimes ends up getting written down, depending on how you're like, if you're running it for your home group, then whatever. Doesn't matter. Yeah. But if you're running at a convention, maybe you're going to grab the title and chuck it into the name of the event that you're running.
Or at least put it in the
description. You might tell your players verbally, hey, I'm running a game written by... Yeah. I do this when I'm running other people's materials. I'm running a game written by so-and-so, titled blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
Now we've given away too much information. I don't mind using... I don't want to stop rolling on those charts. I love them, but I don't mind using them. I think somebody else, I've already lost it now in the chat, kind of mentioned like just have a process of use it as theme, like as a theme input at the very beginning.
Right.
And then at the end, just query the audience and say, okay, now we're going to rename the thing. Now that we've filled out the whole adventure, now we're going to rename it. Who's got ideas?
Right.
And I think that would actually work really well.
There's a question about what is the official title of the Druid in the Adventure. And I'm just looking that up right here, and it is officially Bear Druid currently.
Great. I'm going to credit Bakulius with that idea that I just stole. There you go. Yeah, just pull up the theme. This is the theme that we're rolling for, and then at the end we'll come up with the title. I don't mind that.
Nice. I'm going to make a note of that.
Great. Let's talk about the playtest, Dan. I know you were super eager to jump right into that, and I forced you to back off. let's talk. Now, here's a funny thing about the playtest. This was totally unintentional, but they were literally run in parallel, where Dan and I overlapped by 2 hours. I think there are 4 hour games, and mine started at, I don't know, 11, and yours started at 1 or something like that. Right. Yeah. And so literally they were in separate locations overlapping. In retrospect, I'm not sure that was the best idea, but it is kind of funny that they were run at the exact same time.
You hear that? Yeah. And remind me, so in 3 weeks' time at RPG Con, we avoided that this time. Now it's all mixed up.
We did. Yeah. Separate days. Mine is actually Sunday morning, and I think yours is sometime on Saturday.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So they are. Also,
that makes it, if people are looking for those, it makes them easier to get in one or the other, hopefully.
Yep. Now, the last time we ran it at Rising Phoenix, Dan, you'll remember. Sorry, I keep veering us away. I'm avoiding this topic of actually talking about the playtest. last time we did this at Rising Phoenix, we only ran one game. I was officially the one running that. I was running that, and you ended up being free and just kind of sitting and observing, which I got to observe the end of your game, which is also actually enjoyable. Yes. As for my own edification, I hope none of the players found it creepy that I was like lurking around watching this game.
But
at the very end of that, we had a final encounter where we had like an intelligent lizard folk spellcaster who had a bunch of minions, and we thought, oh, it'll be funny to have Dan come in and control these kind of big bad style. And that was really enjoyable. To which end, it is now in my brain of maybe at Rising Phoenix, maybe we should intentionally try to set ourselves up for that scenario, since our games are not running exactly in parallel, and intentionally choose to play test these things as a co-DM game.
What do you think about that? So, viewers, this is a point where what an interesting idea. What an interesting idea. And I love co-DMing with Paul, of course. The neuron in my brain that fires about that is that I kind of don't mind having like clean room experiences of the two of us running it in total isolation and then finding out what it was like from our different experiences. So I might be like completely hallucinating that's useful. So viewers, how do you feel about that? Should we be disciplined scientists, be disciplined gaming scientists, and get clean data about how it runs separately? Or is the co-DMing so compelling that we should work closer to that? I'm wondering about that.
That is funny, Dan, and just maybe indicative of our personalities, that you want to do disciplined science with repeatable results, where I look at it more as like, well, each dungeon design there should be a unique flower. Let's make this one interesting and different from the last one. Right? Let's sometimes do an outdoor one, and sometimes do a floating island, and sometimes do a co-DM one, and let's have it as...
an experiment is to pursue the co-DM one. Why not do that once? Sure.
and I will say, that Bakuyas is hitting the nail on the head a little bit for me, pointing out that co-DMing is kind of our brand.
Did you hear Paul say that? Are you just repeating something you heard Paul say? It's a compelling argument.
Yeah.
No, I think Bluster's saying, why not do both? And I don't understand how we could possibly do both.
Okay, wait. I'm going to put another comment. You guys, great comments in the chat today here. Mysterious GM asks, co-DM is probably super fun for the players at the con, but it's not something most people trying to run it themselves are going to do. And that's interesting, right? And I think it would be a fun writing challenge, possibly, to present something where we've created a thing that could be run by one DM and could be run by two DMs, and maybe in the actual printed material, we make some pointers and like little DM sidebars where we say, Paul and Dan say, if you're co-DMing, do this, this, this.
All right, I feel pretty warm about that. If I was here alone reading this, I might go, never, ridiculous. But now that I'm with you guys, like, because you saw me get talked into a couple of things during the design dash, actually, that I normally wouldn't accept. But here I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm warm to that. That's That's good stuff. Mm-hmm. That's good stuff. Can I also say there's a suggestion recently that the adventure be retitled to The Beer Dude. And the fact that there actually is a beer component in the adventure, I'm also pretty warm to that. That's clever.
It's beer. Did the beer come up in your play? Okay, let's play notes. We gotta get to talk about the playtest. Come on. We're chewing time here.
Okay, so in broad strokes, the experience is that Paul had four players, which you'd think would be, this is a lesson we've learned more than once, but Paul had four players, which you'd think would be understaffed, and they just cleaved the whole adventure like warm butter, got through everything with an hour to spare, saw every piece of content, and then Paul was trying to create and add new stuff at the end and felt the adventure was clearly too easy. Meanwhile, I had more players. I had six characters at the table, and they found it enormously challenging, tremendously challenging. One of our patrons was in the group, actually, doing their best. But overall, the mix found it enormously challenging. They, at great difficulty, got halfway through, did not see the beer or the giants or the hydra or anything at the end, got halfway through the content as time expired, had a character death, and my takeaway was this is clearly way too hard. This is way too hard an adventure. It needs to be toned down. So Paul was there, came after his adventure ended, assumed he was going to see me in the end state, and then was completely agog that we hadn't gotten to the halfway point, hadn't never got across the river in the adventure.
I was pretty surprised by that. Full disclosure, right? I think we both had players at the table who had been at the stream, right? So I do think that probably impacted my game more than yours, because I had two people at my game, which is 50% of my party, right? Mm-hmm. And so with only four players at the table, two people having seen and kind of knowing some of the content, they were trying their best to like take a back seat and not oversteer the party. But to some degree, when the party's just like, I don't know what to do, right? Like, you got to do something. You know, to some degree, they had more influence probably than they even wanted. Whereas at your table, I believe you're one person who had been at the stream, basically just quietly sat in the back and didn't steer the party at all. Is that true?
Well, interestingly, so the gentleman who did that very kindly at the outset said maybe, and was there with a family member, said maybe I shouldn't play at all because I was at the design. And I said, thank you for saying that. I want everybody at the table participating. Please take a character and just, you know, don't blurt stuff out and don't give away the puzzles in the end game. And interestingly, so with the very opening encounter, you know, the party could not figure out how to successfully navigate that. And that gentleman, you know, kind of to get the action started, just said, I walk into the dungeon, and then triggered the opening very difficult fight. And, you know, sometimes that's not an entirely insane thing to do of just like, you know, why be entirely stuck? Just get some kind of action happening isn't totally crazy. And so that's the thing that kind of stands out in that case, but definitely, you know, was really great about not giving stuff away, and thanks to him for that.
I'm going to put the map up on screen, Dan, just so we can look and talk about this a little bit, since this has not yet been published at this time, so folks maybe don't remember it super well, or I don't even know if they saw the thing. But let's talk a little bit about the first three encounters, the first 1, 2, 3 on this map. At one, we have a couple of mummies. Giant mummies that will attack unless the party solves a puzzle. So sorry, Dan. I'm going to have a coughing fit now.
And I might too, just so people know. There's some codes going around at the moment. We're both making saving throws.
Okay. I'm so sorry, everyone. So you have mummies, but you can get past the mummies by solving the puzzle. At two, we have some jaguars.
And giant jaguars.
Jeez, Dan, I can't get my thoughts out suddenly.
I can talk for a while if you need me to.
I'm gonna push through. My party solved the puzzle, hugged the left wall, avoided the jaguars. My first fight was white eight.
Yeah.
Now you had the
my opposite, party right? had they to find everyone. The hard way, the hardest possible way through all that stuff. You know, and let me say this at the outset. My group, I think a number of people in my group were not familiar with classic D&D tropes. And I'll confess that I was a bit surprised about that at Gary Con, where my thinking is like the whole thing here is among the most old school kind of focused gaming conventions. But I had, when they were picking the characters, it actually went around the table. 5 out of 6 people picked a character. Nobody picked a wizard yet. Nobody had any magic spells. The very last gentleman picked a human wizard to kind of fill that slot. I'm glad he did. But they weren't leveraging that to begin with. People were when the mummy fight started, people were nobody intuited that mummies can only be hit by magic weapons in classic D&D. That was not something that anybody said, not something that was on their minds. So we went around a whole round and a half of combat. No one was picking up on that. I started to make I started every single attack. I'd say, do you have a magic weapon? And if they said yes, I'd go, then it does damage. And if they said no, I'd say it does no damage, right? Do you have a magic weapon? Are you attacking with a magic weapon? And then in the second round, that still wasn't really clear. Now there was a debate about, oh, we're attacking with metal weapons. Maybe wood is what you need. So there was a round where everybody tried to find a non-magical wood weapon and attack with that, which didn't do any good. It went a bunch of rounds before anybody thought to pull out torches and try to attack them with fire. So there might have been some unfamiliarity with tropes that I would expect that made it even harder. So they're fighting the giant mummies. I'm kind of getting ahead of the fact that it got triggered at all. And then one of the thief characters finally, you know, picked up that they don't have a magic weapon. They can't attack it that way. They tried to make an argument that they could successfully punch it because they had a ring of protection. They had a magical ring of protection. So they attacked it. They attacked the giant mummy hand to hand and argued that my punch should be effective. And I ruled no on that. And then finally they said, well, I'm just going to run to the caves, into the dark caves alone. Because, quote, and I wrote this down, quote, surely there must be something in here to help us, and ran directly into cave number 2 with the giant leopards and was gobbled up and consumed entirely off screen.
Which is just delightful. Delightful out there. This brings up a side note, Dan. One of the other conversations we had, which I don't want to necessarily resurface and duke out again here, was just the presence of magic weapons. Should the characters all have them or not? What should the distribution be? We had very different character.
We did.
I do wonder if you want, for the sake of science, maybe we should be using the same character.
Well, I that's not a terrible idea, actually. that would take some work, but actually that's not a bad idea. Maybe we should. Clever.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to do something unprecedented here in 8 seasons of WDMs. I really want to stop coughing into my microphone. I'm going to go grab a cough drop, and I want you to talk.
Yeah.
Go.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that. So I was actually a little bit worried about how much I had to say about the freaking giant mummy fight. So if any viewers here weren't watching the Design Dash, there was a moment when we were designing the area 1, and I think I rolled on a random table and I came up with, how about mummies? And I went on an extended monologue about what a terrible monster mummies are to have an encounter, because it makes for a very slow fight. You need magic weapons, and even with that, they only take half damage normally, and they don't have very, very much damage that they put out either. So mummies make for the very longest fight in classic D&D. And then, so I was like, we shouldn't do that. And then someone in the audience said giant mummies, and more or less that flipped my thinking, and that was just so cool that I was like, okay, well, now I actually want giant mummies. And I'm thinking, look, we're also giving a key to bypass them, right? There's a puzzle here. We don't really intend you to fight the giant mummies. You should just know that that's among the worst things that can possibly happen to you in a D&D game. And again, I don't think my players did know that. So just the existence of giant mummies should say there's got to be some way around this because it's so terrible. And we did actually put two clues, right? There is a whispering wind that you can listen to. And then there's also some stained giant food dishes at their feet, either one that might clue you into what you have to do. When we wrote this, I came away and I was like, you know what? That's too much information. I said, we are making it too easy. There's multiple things to clue them in. My instinct is actually to take one of them away, take the whispering of wind away. I almost did that. I actually did not do that in my game. Now, as Paul reminded me, you know, our acquaintance Alexander would say, you actually want three clues to a puzzle like that. Sure enough, my players did not pick up on either one of them. They didn't listen to the wind. They didn't pick up on the clue about the giant stained food dishes. They thought it might be some kind of weapon or something like that. And were basically stumped until someone stepped into the cave, triggered the fight. And then, sure enough, it was a very long, very brutal fight. And by the time they were done, we were 90 minutes into the session.
Here's my thought, Dan.
Yeah.
Here's my thought on all that. We correctly identified that having a mummy fight at the beginning of the adventure was a terrible idea. Right. And then we got ourselves talked into it because, like, it was thematically cool. And then also the whole, like, oh, but it's actually a puzzle and you can get around it. The problem with, oh, it's actually a puzzle and you can get around it, is that you might not. Right. So we're not saying there's never a mummy fight. Now we're saying there's sometimes a mummy fight, which still, I think we both agree, is not a great experience. I think in hindsight, what I would say, the right fix to this, and you can tell me if you actually want to make this edit or not, is it should not be a mummy fight. We can have giant mummies. They don't necessarily need to be mummy the monster type. Maybe failing to do the thing, failing to lay the food at their feet, produces some other ill effect, triggers some kind of trap. Maybe the mummies just come crashing down and land on you and cause damage. Something. Not a mummy fight.
My instinct is not to make that change. And in fact, so normally we have like a conclusion at the end of the show. And actually here's specifically what I wrote for my conclusion today that addresses this maybe most important of all points, is I actually don't mind a potentially tough play experience. And I do kind of think kind of tournament style. Yes, a little bit. And I like running experiments to see what successful play looks like. So I actually don't mind having potentially bifurcated play experiences to see, you know, to experience good play versus tough play. I actually don't mind.
I would. Yeah. Where we disagree is I wouldn't call it tough play. I would call it boring play. I would say that is not a fun encounter, and I don't want it. I don't mind making it difficult. I don't want it to be dull.
I don't think it was dull. There were some interesting pieces of, like, among other things, the player that was running the Dwarven Thief, I believe. The player that was running the Dwarven Thief, and I fear he might have been, you know, he might have been a little bit frustrated. He was the one that wound up just running into the cave and getting consumed. He'd also, because I say, you know, here's the normal equipment list, you can add extra equipment to your sheets. He also had taken 10 flasks of oil, and I didn't have eyes on that initially, but he expect, you know, with my house rules, I don't permit vegetable-based oil to be burned as a weapon, and so he'd taken a whole pack full of flasks of oil. Then discovered that I wasn't going to let them use them as Molotov cocktails, and then instead started to use them to make slippery spots, right? And then poured them out in order to make a big slippery puddle, and the fighters that didn't have magic weapons were trying to trip the giant mummies to get them on the ground and not attacking for a round and make it easier to hit them. So there were, it was long, but there was some interesting stuff of like, can one person was trying to, you know, has great 8C, great armor. They're trying to aggro the mummies, attack me instead of them. The one thief had a magic sword, so they're trying to get around and backstab them. So there was some interesting stuff. We could survey the players. Maybe they had a different experience of it. I don't mind, you know, I'm coming off the tournament the prior night that was altered designed with the same sensibility.
I mean, I can't argue whether or not you found it fun or not, but personally, yeah. I would not want to DM that fight.
Fun is not necessarily my threshold. Fun's not necessarily the trajectory the target that I'm pursuing.
Now we're getting into Dan and Paul have a value. Okay. when I will run it, I will change them to not
dumb mummies. Interesting. Okay. Well, that's a big.
Change. As we've discussed on this channel before, the mummies. Yeah. I think mummy fights are not fun, right? They're a slog because they're high defense, low offense, right? And so there's just it's the same problem I have with Warhammer Fantasy Second Edition when it gets at very high level. The higher level you get in that game, everybody has more attacks and a higher chance to defend against an attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which means we just roll more dice for the same outcome. We just roll three times the amount of dice we used to have to roll. That, in my mind, not fun.
I mean, I said the same thing before we put it in with a puzzle to bypass it. So it's not like that's a crazy thing to say. So maybe
right, move on. Has, we clearly disagree on this. Let's move on.
Okay.
So, but it is actually maybe we can verge a little bit though into the general discussion of. Do you change the content on the fly and not, or at all, or not, especially based on what you have at the table? Because this was in my head as well. I had four players. It was scheduled to run for eight. And they went, ooh, is that going to be bad? What effect is that going to have?
Right.
And originally I thought, I'll reduce the number of things they're facing. Right? I have half the party members, I'll have half the monsters.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seemed like a reasonable, easy thing to do.
Agreed.
I never did that. Dan, I never did that. I won't say never. I did throw two white apes at him, which is what's in the thing. Uh-huh. There were two giant mummies, although they never had to fight them. They fought the Hydra. They fought all of the giants. I did have not all the giants show up at once, right? The giants came in over time. Originally, because in my head, I thought, I should cut the number. And then they were just having such an easy time. I was like, don't cut the numbers. Throw them in. And in fact, maybe I saw what we've discussed in the past from the big bad is that possibly by having a smaller number, they have an advantage rather than a disadvantage.
Totally.
We learned this all. Smaller party size actually moves faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And has better generally has better tactical awareness of what their abilities are and tend to synchronize better. We learn this over and over again to our recurrent surprise. But let me just rewind a little bit, Paul, because once we table the mummy fight, right, with area two, your players bypassed that, and again, my players did not. So we also had a big, brutal, long, drawn-out fight with the giant jaguars as well. And they went into that room partly because they knew that the prior thief had gone in there and died, and maybe they thought they could possibly rescue him. Tried to scout it out, and then I get attacked by the jaguars there, and we have a brutal fight at the mouth of Cave 2, and a couple, I think one of the characters might have needed to make a death save, possibly, get pulled out. They're using up most of the healing jugs that I've given them at that point, and then another big fight happens with Area 2 that they couldn't avoid either.
So here's an interesting one. I mean, obviously, that's bad luck on their end that they just stumbled forward and triggered the jaguars while they were still mid-fight with the mummies. That's just awful. In my case, right, my players didn't fight the mummies. They're walking into the tunnel. They start to see a little distance ahead, and they see that the tunnel's about to split left and right, and they have to make a choice which direction to take.
Right.
Now, in the beginning, I did give them all the clues around the giant mummies, including that there was a wind, a little bit of whispering wind coming out of the cave. They did not actually hear the words. They never you know, they never gave me any indication of like, oh, I'm listening or I'm trying to hear, or I stop and feel the wind or anything like that. That never happened. They picked up the idea to put the food in the jars just because they were like, oh, there's jars with food in it. Let's put more food. So then they get in there, and then when I say, okay, and you see the split, they say, well, that wind that we were feeling, which direction is it coming from?
Nice.
And I went, oh, geez. I didn't think of that. But if it's got the druid's words on the wind, it's probably coming from the druid, I guess, was my logic. So I was like, I guess that would lead you left, I guess. I don't know. Do you, would you rule the same way?
Sure, absolutely. 100%.
Well, that's 95%. That's what I gave them, and so they, sure enough, that was the little nudge they needed to decide to go left instead of right, and thus avoid the Jaguars.
Yeah. And again, with me, they knew that another character had gone in, had gone right, and they were kind of pursuing after him, which led them directly into the Jaguars instead.
Yep.
So everything was hard. So they got through area three. The thief went up the cliff alone, got grabbed. They did make a fairly good tactical withdrawal with the fighters with shields at a distance, so that the thrown rocks weren't working. White apes came down. They defeated them in melee. And then for me, they went to area four, and they spent a long time. They were very, like, I made the chained up bear scary. I made it not able to communicate in words. They were very, cautious, very, very cautious about it. A wizard, they stayed at a distance. A wizard cast fly and dropped carcasses of the prior monsters on it in order to feed it, was their thought process. And after kind of an extended, you know, careful exploration, someone finally dared get in range. A thief did actually pick open the manacles. And then, you know, as they were trying to interrogate it, and I was, you know, not speaking English, I was acting like a bear that couldn't speak, they, you know, their guess was the opposite. Their guess was actually, you've been imprisoned by an evil druid, you hate the druid, right? You hate the druid. And so I played it as getting more and more aggravated, more and more frustrated that it couldn't say, I am the druid, right? Like, oh, and I go, and they're like, yes, you hate the druid, yes, you should come with us and kill the druid, take your revenge. That's what should happen. So that didn't
that's
help.
Hilarious.
They did rescue it, that's right? Hilarious. They did free it, and they did rescue it. So that's kind of one of the main goals there. So everything was hard. Everything was real hard.
Yeah, we definitely played the druid slightly differently. Again, yeah. I don't think either terribly wrong based on the description of what we talked about here. My druid was more exhausted, wounded, just kind of draped there, bleeding. I went with the idea I can't remember if this is in our text or was just somebody's. Yeah, it says it right in there, right? He's being bled to feed the Hydra. So he's there. He's been, you know, there's bowls lying around holding his blood. I did decide that by freeing him from the shackles, that was enough to return his ability to become human again, because I did look at this as the one social encounter in the entire dungeon. This is the one case where the players get to talk to an NPC, and that's interesting. So my players were very sympathetic to the poor bear. They immediately decided we have to free him. I don't know if they knew he was the druid or not, but they were just like, we got to free this poor bear. They unshackle him. He turns back into a man. He's beat up. He's bewildered. He's not very smart, right? He can't invoke his own magic anymore. He's got one hit point, I figured. He's kind of talking in sentence fragments, and he's not being very helpful. They do their best to try and like get a little information out of him and kind of walk him back and be like, go try to make your way out of the cave, buddy. We're going to keep exploring it. My group then explored the northern passage out of four. They were like,
yeah,
mine's
it too.
Check this out. Right. And they kind of went, okay, well, they found the river and thought, well, this is maybe an escape route. That's nice. They then flew across the river. So they never avoided the bridge. They avoided the trolls. They flew across the river. They found the treasure that was hiding in the river without getting in the way of the piranhas. Climbed up onto the cliff and then had a big old fight with the Hydra and the ogres, or the giants rather, and they destroyed them. Literally, they destroyed. Amazing. They destroyed the Hydra in one round, Dan, which was the shocker to me. In one round, the Hydra comes out and they were just like, they hit it like a ton of rocks. They just let loose the, you know, every power they had, and just unloaded massive damage on the Hydra in a single
amazing game. Amazing.
Maybe it was two. Maybe I'm misremembering. It might have taken them two, but it was still real fast.
Amazing. Yeah. You know, it highlights, you know, the flying over the river couldn't happen for me. So then the very last thing that happened as time ran out is my party had to go to the bridge at five and had to get in a fight with the Scrags. Is that with a smaller party, you have more transportation options. So were they flying with the magic carpet that one of your characters had?
The wizard had a broom of flying, which can move at quarter speed with one extra person. And so the wizard basically ferried them across.
Got it.
One by one.
So it's like a wolf, sheep, corn puzzle type thing, right?
Sort of. Yeah.
And mine didn't have that as an option. Mine did not have that as an option. The one wizard had a fly spell, but that wouldn't allow them to get six people over the river. So it's interesting. Yep. That's another. And I mean, that's what we learned in the Big Bad, right? Is with the web DM group that made it look so easy, right? They had one super, super fast monk, and that's all it took is really great transportation ability to cut through the challenges a lot more quickly. And that can help you out a lot. Very interesting.
And for what it's worth, I have 12 character sheets I bring to the table. And so they picked four of them. So there was a good chance that they didn't come to the table with that particular ability, but they chose it.
I had to go through seven. I had to go through seven sheets by the time I was done. Now I will say, so, you know, thinking about the interaction with the druid, and this is a place where I might legitimately be a meaner DM than Paul is that I made him, I thought it was interesting and dramatic to make him scary. So I was playing it up to be scary, and my players were more cautious as a result of that. Okay, granted. I explained and they noticed the incisions that he was, you know, being drained. So that was all, you know, known to them. And then, yeah, when he did get unmanacled, I did not let him change back to human, because my thinking was, okay, and, you know, my thinking was that was the power of the lead giant, who has an effect like Feeble Mind, right? And so I didn't think it was an effect of the manacles or the imprisonment, but the Feeble Mind type spell that would be lasting for an extended period of time. And we never explicated exactly how long that stuff lasted, but I was thinking at least days or weeks or something like that, similar to the Scrags that are weakened on a long-term basis.
Yeah. We never really discussed that point. Now, I will say, I'm not sure that it makes a huge difference here.
Agreed.
You know, again, frankly, in retrospect, when I heard you describe it, I was like, oh, I wish I had made him fearsome and angry when they first. Okay. I think that would be entertaining and fun. Okay. I would still have him turn back into a human if and when they decide to free him, because I think it's a nice reward for doing the right thing, and I do like there to be a social encounter if possible. I like to roleplay NPCs, and that's the only option in this whole adventure to roleplay. Right?
Interesting.
Everything is a monster.
Interesting.
Now that said,
what about the werebears?
Feeble-minded. The werebears. Yeah. I guess you could. The werebears. I forgot about them. Yeah, I guess actually my party never really found the werebears. Yeah, that's a good point. In this case, again, I did assume he was still feeble-minded. Right, so he was not giving them a lot of great information, right? He wasn't telling them, here's where everything is, right? Just said, yep, that way, pointed across the river.
Got it.
My captors are that way, right? Essentially. That's all the information he gave them.
Here, let me throw out an edit. So I made a couple of hand edits in my adventure, not too much. I mean, that was to make the bear scarier. I, looking at the map, and I think I said this to you, Paul, and maybe you weren't super warm to it, but looking at the map later, you know, and my thinking with the werebears and eight was maybe players could get there, free them, and then they would say, hey, that giant bear, that's the actual druid that's imprisoned.
That's the druid.
Yeah. And then go back was a possible path that I was thinking about. But looking at the map, there's nothing in Area 7, right, other than the pond. Mm. Some treasure in it, and I kind of a very interesting cliff there with stairs that go up the side, and my thinking was I kind of want I kind of want to fight with the Hydra off the cliff. So the little bit of the edit that I had was to make the Hydra chained up, but potentially loosable by the giants. And when you fight the Scrags, one of them runs off, alerts the giants, and when they know that there's enemies in the complex, they release the Hydra. And then you, when you come through seven, there's lichens to light the whole place up so you can see it. And there's just like a whole bunch of heads coming off the cliff and picking people up out of seven to their doom, is something that I kind of wanted to see. So obviously my players didn't get that far.
It's a good edit, and I recommend it, because actually it's almost exactly what happened to my party. Oh, okay. My party came up seven. Now they did climb the cliff, so then now they're in that empty space in front of eight and nine. And then they dick around there and they decide, let's have loud conversations here and like not decide what to do. And so I basically decided, well, the Hydra's chained up in nine, the giants hear what's going on and they loose the Hydra. Right. So the door to nine comes slamming open, out comes the Hydra. And sure enough, we have a fight that's with the Hydra seven. Now, granted, again, my players weren't, I do like the visual of like they're down below and the heads are snapping down at them. That's very clever. I would love to do that. Yeah. Not sure it would matter super much with my party with the flight issue, right?
Okay. Yep. Noted. Yep.
Right. Or various ranged attacks and et cetera. I want to, before we run out of time, I want to mention one joyful moment where I decided I needed to change this thing up a little bit for the people who had been watching the stream. And so I decided to just randomly re-roll the potions that were in the treasure in the river that they found.
Great.
And I landed on a potion of telekinesis and a potion of diminution. Randomly. And sure enough, in the final fight with the giants, my party decided to weaponize those two items by drinking the potion of telekinesis and then using it to take the potion of diminution and deliver it into the mouth of one of the giants. Which was just That's absolutely great. Delightful.
The prior night in the tournament I was running, a potion of diminution also came critically into play when someone was trapped and then drank it to get out of the trap they were in. Now, before time runs out, I got to share briefly, Paul, the fact that when your party wrapped up quickly, you were looking to fill in more content at the end. And so when we were designing it, the last thing that we put on the Wandering Monster list is I made a roll, dragon, blue dragon. And we had a big laugh. And we said at the time, Paul would clearly not actually do that, but Dan, who's evil, might actually have the blue dragon come in. And that again got flipped because I wasn't rolling for wandering monsters. And then you actually had the dragon come in, right? And contend with the players at the end, right?
When the players were done a good hour plus with time to spare, they were going to leave. And I was like, I got to do something more dramatic and fun because they just wiped the walls with the Hydra and the giants. So I just put that. I didn't even roll for it, Dan. I just plucked that blue dragon right off the table and I shoved him in the river. And so as they come back out on seven, who lifts their head up out of the water? It's a giant ancient blue dragon, and the party is carrying all the treasure, literally like all the treasure of the whole place. They've loaded it up into treasure chests and they're carrying it out there. And the dragon says, "Thank you for retrieving my treasure. Please spread it out on my beach so that I can bask in it." And they say, "Yes, sir." And they do exactly that. They lay out all the treasure and the dragon goes, "Ooh, good, good, good. This is not, now go out there and get more treasure." And they say, "Yes, sir." And they take off. That's the end of mine.
That's so funny. That's so hilarious. Oh my God, I love that so much. So again, the completely opposite expectations about who was going to use the dragon and who was what was going to happen just completely delighted me when Paul told me that. That's really amazing.
And you know, there was a little part of me that was disappointed that we didn't get to end with a nice big juicy dragon fight. I was like, we got an hour, we can do a dragon fight. And they were like, no. We're not doing that. Nope. Dragon gave us an out. He said, get him treasure. We're going to do that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, guys.
Okay. You
we
know
work
what?
For an ancient blue dragon now. Yeah. All right, Dan, we have 1 minute left, which is not enough time for anything. But I want to leave you with this one thought, and you may not have an answer, and you can cogitate on it and answer it later, maybe on our Discord server or something. Given your desire for this clean, white room A-B test of how people play these dungeons, is that really good science when we clearly have such different DMing styles?
I am going to, that is a deep question. I am going to have to think about that. Maybe yeah. another episode.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Good because question. I remember you also bringing that up about one of the problems with the tournament of like, what? It's sloppy because
yeah.
DM to DM, the style is going to be different.
Yeah. That is true.
All right. I leave you with that. That's my final thought, Dan. Do you have a final thought you want to throw out there before we log off here?
Well, I already shared it earlier. I actually don't mind a tough play experience, and I don't. There was a point that like maybe about 2 hours in where I said, you know what? I'm just going to embrace what's happening. Things are happening a little bit more slowly. This is it for this party to on this day with me as DM. This is a tough adventure. I'm not going to try to rush it to the conclusion. I'm not going to try to speed run to see everything. I'm just, this is what's happening today. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with a potentially tough, potentially bifurcated experience, depending on how people approach a thing.
I'm okay with the fact that you and I disagree, Dan, I've said in the past, I like adventures that have a good amount of white space that leave a lot up DM interpretation. I like that in my writing. Yeah. I like that in the adventures we build. I don't mind having that. I'm almost inclined to go even further in that direction and say, maybe it would be very clever if we started putting like a commentary track, if you will, into some of these adventures. Paul says, my mummies suck. I don't want to do this fight. Here's another option for how you could run this.
this really delights me. This is funny.
here's my pitch to you, Dan. If we ever accumulate enough of these and decide one of these is we're going to collect them together in a big volume and bind them into a book and sell it or give it away or whatever we're going to do with it, we should actually absolutely do a pass coming back where we each write our own independent sidebars for each adventure. Here's how I ran it. Here's what I would do. Here's what Dan's probably going to hate this, but I would do this. Here's what happened That's when really I ran good. It that way. I think that would be really
interesting. We got to do this more, Paul, because I'm so surprised by what happened. I don't think this can happen every time. I don't believe that every single one of these things that we run are we going to have absolutely night and day experiences with. So we need to do that. We need to do this more to find out, Paul.
Gotcha. So your argument then is no co-DMing at Rising Phoenix. You want another you want another taste of that A/B test of us both running.
Find some way to do the A/B testing. If we do co-DMing at RPG as its own experiment, that's fine too. But we need to do more after that so that we can have more A/B testing.
Yeah,
more DP.
Given how improvisational our given how improvisational our style creating of these things is, I don't mind having all those ideas written down on a little piece of paper next to us and then see what happens.
Yeah, that's, you know what? That's not bad too.
Great. All right, wonderful. Viewers, if you have some thoughts, if you've run this adventure and have some thoughts to share, experiences to share, I would love to hear from you. If you have thoughts on what you want to see from future Dungeon Design Dashes, please let us know. Leave us a comment here in the YouTube video comment section. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows what will come next in the next Dungeon Design Dash. We'll find out soon because it's in less than a month.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and dissect that like button.
If you prefer to listen to these shows as audio-only podcasts, you can do so. Those audio files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com, as well as through various third-party carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on a third-party carrier and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users find us, and we appreciate
it. We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation can use 24/7, but everything we love about gaming, old and new, is all there. And we just have the smartest, best patrons with some of the best ideas that help us out all the time. And we would love for you to join us. We'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation. I have more notes, Paul. I actually have things that we didn't get to in the hour. So this is a stuffed topic, and I have more to say. And if other people have stuff, I want to hear that from them as well. Great chat going by very quickly today, so I'm sure I missed some really good points there. Now, we have, like Paul said, this next weekend, we have our Indie House Con that we have up in Massachusetts with a small number of friends. We are almost certainly not going to have our normal 1 p.m. show next Sunday. We may possibly have a surprise streaming game from a table at some point, possibly Friday or Saturday or Sunday, maybe. So kind of check the channel if that happens, but we won't have our normal show next week. And we will be back in 2 weeks' time. Is that, if I got that date right, Paul?
Yep, absolutely.
And then after that, we're showing up at Rising Phoenix Game Con in 3 weeks. So look for us there if you are in the Massachusetts area and you can get to, we love RPG Con. So we would love to see you there. So that's what's on our docket. Please do. Please do. People that run it. Wonderful people. And don't forget, please. We are live most Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again in 2 weeks for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.